We'd like to read verses 10 to 17. We're breaking in the chapter and not read a long section of it, but Mordecai has asked Esther to go and petition the king on the behalf of God's people. And this is where we're breaking into the chapter in verse 10. Again, Esther spake unto Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come into the king unto the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And behold, they told Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether hold thy peace at this time, then there shall enlargement or deliverance and freedom arise to the Jews from another place, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Then Esther bade them return to Mordecai this answer, go and gather all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and eat neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens fast, will fast likewise, and so will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. The Lord will bless his inspired word to us. The only book in the Bible where God's name is not mentioned. Let me give you, firstly, a little background to the book of Esther, so we may easily understand the time at which these events took place. Between 485 and 465 BC, many of the Jews had returned from their exile in Babylon about 20 or 30 years previous to this. Ezra had already built the house of the Lord, rebuilt it back in Jerusalem. Now, 20 years after the temple or the house of the Lord was rebuilt in Jerusalem, still, the majority of the Jews that were alive remained in what was now called the Persian Empire. More stayed than went back. The Persian Empire was the new world superpower because the Persians took over Babylon, you see. So it was the Empire of Persia. That's the time. The place, the Persian Empire, many Jews in the Persian Empire, they had lived there for generations. They had never been, for many of them, been born in Persia. They'd never been to Jerusalem or the Holy Land, as we call it. And Persia was their home. They didn't want to go back to Israel, to a nation that had a faltering economy and hard work rebuilding the walls and the threat of continual attack. They were an accepted part of the Persian Empire, which was the world superpower in this day. They were accepted as part of it. The events of Esther take place in the city of Susa, it tells us. That's in modern day Iran. Susa was one of the three capital cities in the Empire of Persia. And in Susa was the king's winter palace. That's where he went in the winter. It must have been warmer than some of the other parts. The palace where lots of the events in the book of Esther take place, or citadel, chapter 1, verse 5, was an acropolis or a fortress that was set up high 120 feet above the level of the rest of the city. So if you look on a map to the tip of the Persian Gulf and go inland 100 miles to the northwest or to the left and slightly up, that's where Susa was. The empire of Persia was vast. 127 provinces, each governed by what was called a satrap or a local king, all of which reported to the king or emperor of Persia. He was an absolute monarch. He had complete control. The people involved in the story of the book of Esther. King Ahasuerus. That's his name, in the, one of his names. In secular history, he is known as King Xerxes. King Xerxes reigned from 485 to 465 BC, and as a person, this king was described by a historian as, quote, reckless, sensual, cruel, and capricious, end of quote. It was this king, Ahasuerus or Xerxes, that led the war against the Greeks. You've all heard of the 300 Spartans holding off against the Persian army for 3 days. That was King Xerxes. This is Ahasuerus that led that attack against the Greeks and the Spartans. So that's one of the people in the story, this great king. The second man I want to introduce to you as part of the background is Haman. Haman is a cruel man. He has been promoted to the first minister of the kingdom or empire of Persia. He's the second most powerful man in the world. He's the prime minister. He's an Agite, chapter 3, verse 1, which means he was connected to King Agag, who was an enemy of God's people, arch enemies of Israel. And then we have Esther. Esther, the Jewish girl who had lost both her parents, and Mordecai, her cousin, who looked after her. We are told in the Bible from what it says, she was startlingly beautiful, and her cousin Mordecai looked after her as his own daughter. Chapter 2 and verse 7. She became the queen of Persia in 479 BC, although it wasn't through her own choice. She didn't have any say in it. Mordecai we're going to look at in the next point. But that's the setting. The setting. The time, 485 to 465 BC, the place, Persia, the city of Susa, and the people, the king, the prime minister, Esther, and Mordecai. Let me tell you secondly something about the man Mordecai. He's a believing Jew that has a good job. He worked in the palace, in the king's court, in the citadel. We often find him in the king's gate, it says in chapter 2, verse 21, 3, verse 2, 5, verse 9, and chapter 13, verses 6, 10, and 12. In the king's gate, in the king's gate, over and over and over. He is a Persian official, probably worked for the government under the king, and he has a high power government job. Second thing about Mordecai is this, he's kind and caring. How do we know that? Well, he took care of young Esther. He took her under his care, chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. And when she was taken to the palace harem, the Bible tells us that he visited her every single day, chapter 2 and verse 11. A kind, caring man. A man that is honest and just. Not a rebel. We read in chapter 2, verse 21 to 23, that when two of the palace guards, Bigthan and Teresh, were plotting to assassinate the king, Ahasuerus, it tells us actually in the Bible they were the guards to the threshold, which means they were the guards at the door of the throne room. They made a plan to assassinate the king. Mordecai the Jew heard about it, and he reported it to Esther, who told the king. The crime or the plot was investigated, and the two men were put to death, it tells us in chapter 2, verse 23. Not only was he honest and just, he was a man of prayer, and he encouraged prayer. We see that repeatedly throughout the book of Esther. And also, note also about this man Mordecai, he refused to pay homage to Haman in the king's court. He wouldn't bow down, and he said he wouldn't bow down to any other human, and he stuck to his guns. It tells us that in chapter 3, verses 2 to 4. Let me read it to you. It's very interesting. Chapter 3, verses 2 to 4. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, the prime minister, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants which were in the king's gate said to Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, every day, and he listened not, he hearkened not to them, that they told Haman, they told the prime minister, to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. He said he wasn't going to bow, and he didn't bow down to the wicked Haman. He didn't do what he said he wasn't going to do. His word was his bond. He said it, and he stuck to it. And him holding to his word was a witness to others, because it says others watched him to see if he would stand by his word. And he did stand by his word, and he never bowed. So that's Mordecai, the person, the faithful Jew, kind and caring, honest and just, a man of prayer, and a man whose word was his bond. But now we come to the problem, thirdly. There's a problem, you see, in chapter 3 and verses 5 and 6. A startling and dangerous problem. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the whole empire, even the people of Mordecai. Evil Haman is the problem. In his fury and his hatred, which was fed by his pride in himself, human pride, it was not enough for him to want to punish the one man that would not bow. But he wanted to exterminate a whole group of people, all the Jews. Mass homicide. Hitler was not the first, nor was he the last, nor actually was he the worst. Stalin killed almost 8 or 9 times the amount of people that Hitler killed. That's not mentioned. Stalin was our ally, of course. But Hitler was not the first nor the last to want mass extermination of a people group. And this evil prime minister approaches the emperor, or the king Ahasuerus, and tells him, there is a subversive people living in your empire, and they do not obey your law, and they are of no profit to you. Which is, of course, a total lie, because the Jews did obey the law and were very profitable. Total lie. But if you read in the passage, he offers to pay a 10,000 talents of silver bribe right into the king's personal treasury. An enormous bribe. If you will give me authority to do, or to have all the Jews exterminated. Now, a 10,000 talent bribe is massive. It's reckoned the whole Persian Empire, the most powerful empire in the world in this day, had an annual revenue of 30,000 talents of silver. Oh, sorry, no, 10,000 talents of silver was two-thirds of the annual income of the whole empire. That's like two-thirds of the income of the United States of America being given to one man as a bribe. A massive bribe. And he says, I'll put that into your treasury if you let me exterminate the Jews. And the king said, okay. And he stamped the law with his signet ring on the wax. So the problem is basically this. An evil man in the place of power, because of his hatred and wickedness fueled by his human pride in himself, draws up evil legislation against God's people. And that's what this man, Haman, did in the corridors of power. Familiar. An evil man in the place of political power, drawing up evil legislation against God's people. So I've set you the background, the time and the place, the people involved. The man Mordecai, a man with a good Jew with a good job, a believing Jew with a good job, kind and caring, honest and just, a man of prayer, and his word was his bond. And the problem was Haman, this evil man, bringing in evil legislation and planning mass murder of the people of God. What happened? Well, chapter 4, verses 1 and 2 is what happened. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, he rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry and came before the king's gate, for none might enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In the time when the evil politician was passing wicked legislation against God's people, the man of God, Mordecai, wept and prayed in sackcloth and ashes for God's people. It always starts there. But it doesn't end there. Then the man of God challenged the woman of God in the place of power, the queen, to stand now and do something about it. That's chapter 4, verses 6 to 8. Esther, go and intercede with the king. But Esther sends back the passage I read to you. I can't go in. You can't go into the king uninvited. It's against the law to go into the throne room uninvited. And if you go into the throne room uninvited, the law is you will be put to death. Unless the king stretches out his golden scepter and you touch the tip of it, and then your life will be spared. And she says, I haven't been invited in to see the king for 30 days. And this reply from Esther back to Mordecai prompts one of the classic texts in the whole of the Bible. Chapter 4, verse 13 and 14. For if thou... Sorry, 13 and 14. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether hold thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Queen Esther, don't hold your peace at this time, he said. And we see in this Mordecai's reply, he trusts in God, in the providence of God. You know, sometimes we go through life and we try this and try the other, and things just happen and happen just at the right time to steer us right exactly to where God wants us. That's what people call providence. God's in control. But this man trusts in God's providence, verse 14. He believes that we, God's people, the Queen, are just instruments that God uses to help and deliver his people. But if we don't do it, he still believes that God will deliver his people in another way. Even if Esther refused, he believes that. He trusts in the providence of God. But he says to her, Queen Esther, now is the time to make a stand. And he says, Queen Esther, who knows whether you are come into the kingdom. You've been put right in this place in God's plan for just such a time as this. You know what he's saying? My cousin, my queen, could it be that God has put you right there in the palace just for this very purpose? Well, of course he had. Then the woman of God, in the place of power, says she will stand up and speak for God's people in 3 days' time. 3 days. And she says in chapter 4, verses 15 to 17, to get all the people to pray for 3 days. And then I'll go in to the throne room anyway, whether I live or whether I die. Willing to put her life on the line. And what happened? God's people prayed and fasted for 3 days. And then Queen Esther went in to the king, chapter 5 and verse 3, and God answered her prayer and the prayers of God's people. And within 2 days, 48 hours, God had overruled the world superpower and he had turned the whole situation around for the good of his people. But let me tell you the story, because it's better in story form, isn't it? The queen invited the king and the prime minister Haman to her apartments for a feast. And they both came. Haman, of course, was very proud. It was only him and the king were the only people invited. He's so proud of himself. His human pride sticks out like a mile all the way through the book. And they both came, and the king asked the queen at the feast, what do you want? What's your petition? And the queen says, tomorrow I want you both to come back for another feast. And then I'll tell you what I want. And wicked Haman, the prime minister, who'd bribed the king, and planned to kill all the Jews, goes home, and you read it in the passage yourself, he goes home full of pride, past Mordecai at the king's gate, who still doesn't bow, and he goes back home that night, and he boasts to his wife, and he boasts to his advisors, about how great he is, and how just he and the king are invited to another feast tomorrow, and he's so proud of it all. But he says, but it's all worth nothing. It's all worth nothing as long as I see Mordecai not bowing to me. I want him dead. So his advisor advises him in chapter 5, verses 11 to 14, to build a gallows for hanging Mordecai 50 cubits high, that's 75 feet high, over 3 houses high. And ask the king early in the morning, before you go to the feast with the queen, to hang Mordecai on the gallows. And then you can go to the feast with the queen and the king happy. And Haman liked that idea, and that's exactly what he did. So it's all plotted. Mordecai will be dead before the feast happens, and the queen asks her petition. The evil man lays his plan. However, and this is where you see the handiwork of God in all these coincidences. It's all planned. The godly man will be dead before the feast. But however, on this night of all nights, the king can't sleep. Chapter 6. That's Providence 1. He just keeps the king awake. And because the king can't sleep, he commanded, it says, that the book of the records of the chronicles of the king be brought in and read to him. So if he can't sleep, get somebody to read you a history book. Because that's what that is. There's the volumes of the chronicles of the king, all about the king's rule. Bring me in a volume of the chronicles of the king and read it to me. And on that very night, out of all the books, all the chronicles of the volume of the king, the servant who brings in the book happens to bring out in a certain particular one of the volumes. And out of the whole book, he happens to turn to the particular page where Mordecai the Jew exposes the assassination attempt on the king. Providence 2. And the king asks the servant, what honour was done to Mordecai for foiling the assassination attempt? And the servant says, nothing. Mordecai was never rewarded. And the king asks, who's in my outer court now? And the servant says, Haman's there. He's come early to ask the king to put Mordecai to death. And just then the king brings Haman in. And before Haman can ask for the death of Mordecai, the king says these words. What should be done for someone that the king wants to honour? And Haman in his pride thinks it's him. And he says, put a royal crown on his head. Put a royal robe on him. Set him on the king's horse and have some great dignitary lead the man round the city of Susa crying out, this is the man that the king wants to honour. And the king says, very good, go and do that for Mordecai. Oh dear, dear. And he has to go to the man he hates and wants dead, the man he hates more than anyone in all the world. He has to go and put a royal crown on his head and put the king's robe on him, put him on the king's horse and lead him round the city, crying out to all the people, this is the man that the king wants to honour. That's Providence 4, isn't it? Totally humiliated. Do you think this has all just happened by chance? All in God's plan, just at the right moment. But it's not over yet. The wicked Haman goes home humiliated, and just as he gets home, it tells us the servants arrive to take him to the queen's feast in the carriage, and he doesn't want to go, but he has to go. When he goes to the queen's feast, which is just the king and the queen and him, and at the feast of wine, it gets worse. The queen tells the king that she's a Jew and that her and her people have been sold to be destroyed. Chapter 7, verse 4. And the king looks across the table and he says, who is he who has dared to do this? And the queen points across the table and says, him. Your prime minister, Haman. And Haman, I'm sure he near choked on what he was eating. And the king, it says, rose in wrath and fury and went out through the doors into the garden just outside the queen's apartments, chapter 7, verse 7, to think what he's going to do with this prime minister. And Haman doesn't go out in the garden. He stays behind, chapter 7, verse 8, to beg the queen for his life. And he gets up and he goes across to the queen to beg for his life. And the king's coming back in through the doors, and as Haman's about to beg for his life, he trips on the carpet and falls right on top of the queen. You read it in your Bible. He falls right on top of the queen, and the king comes through the door, and he sees Haman on top of the queen, and he thinks he's attacking the queen. And from that moment, the wicked prime minister's doom is sealed. And he brings in his guards, and Haman's face is covered. And he is led out of the apartments. And the king hears that Haman has built gallows 75 feet high for Mordecai the Jew, and he commands that Haman be hung upon the gallows that he made for the man of God. And Mordecai the Jew gets the prime minister job, and he becomes the second most powerful man in the world. And the Jews are saved. Do you see God's providence? His hand in these times and events. He worked, God worked, evil Haman's plans for the good of his people. Like it says in the Psalm number 7, verses 15 and 16. He made a pit and digged it, and has fallen into the ditch which he made. His mischief shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate. His plans were used on himself. Brethren, this is the God we worship. And he hasn't changed one bit. He is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. He doesn't change. What's the message of the book of Esther? That God delivers his people through means. Through Mordecai, the man of God. Through Queen Esther. Through the people of God in high places. Through the fervent prayer of God's people. That's the lesson of the whole book. It's when men of God challenge God's people who are in places of power and authority to make a stand, and God's people in places of authority make a stand, even to their own cost, even if it's against the law. Because when a law contradicts God's law, we have to obey God rather than men. That's what the Bible says. And when God's people fast and pray about the situation, it is then that God turns evil legislation for the good of his people. Surely that's the message of the book of Esther. When men and women of God challenge God's people in places of political power to make a stand for the truth, and when God's people in places of political power do make a stand for the truth, and don't just watch their own backs, but make a stand for the truth, and God's people fast and pray, it is then and only then that God turns evil legislation right around for the good of his people. The application is obvious, isn't it? In the United Kingdom, especially in Northern Ireland, where are the special men of God who are challenging God's people who are in the corridors of power, and to make a stand? And do God's people in the corridors of power make a stand for the truth, really? And are God's people weeping and praying about the situation? If these things are not happening, brethren, it is no wonder that evil legislation is passed and not changed, not challenged, but even accepted by Christians so-called in the places of political power. But make no mistake, God will deliver his people. He will. Mordecai said to Esther, if not by you, he'll deliver his people in some other way. But you and your family will perish if you don't make a stand. That's what I'd love to say to our politicians. See, if you don't make a stand, politicians, if you profess to be a Christian and you just capitulate for the sake of money to evil legislation and you don't make a stand, God will deliver his people. But you will suffer. You'll stand and give an account to God one day for your compromise. Christians, could it be that you and I are brought to the kingdom for such a time as this. God has placed us where we are, here, tonight and now, for a particular purpose. It's in God's plan. It is. And we may think, I often think, I wish God had placed me in another time. Not a time of decline of Christianity in our nation, but in a time of growth. Maybe you think that too. Maybe Esther thought that, and Mordecai could have thought it as well. Oh, these times are hard, and we're going to be oppressed as a people. But they didn't. They didn't moan about it. They were faithful to the Lord. They prayed, and they took a stand. And all God's people prayed, and God answered. Because they were people that were brought to the kingdom for such a time as this. As are you and I. Whether we like it or not, God has brought us here for such a time as this. There was a wee man preaching in a primitive Methodist church in the 1850s. The preacher hadn't turned up that day. It was snowing too heavy. So this wee man got up and preached. And he couldn't preach. He just kept repeating over the same verse. Look unto me, all ye ends of the earth, and be ye saved, for I am God, and there is none else. Over and over. What he didn't know was that Charles Haddon Spurgeon had come into that church because of the snowstorm and sat down at the back and heard those words. And he even said the man couldn't preach himself, but the word spoke. And he looked unto the Lord and was saved. And he looked his eyes away. Well, that wee man that couldn't preach was brought into the kingdom right on that exact night for such a time as this. To see and influence a man who would preach and see tens of thousands of men and women saved. It was just a wee woman talking about spiritual things on the streets of Bedford. They didn't even know what they were doing, the influence they would have. It was overheard by a man called John Bunyan, one of the Baptist Puritans who got converted through their words and wrote The Pilgrim's Progress and many other books and saw many, many people converted through his books, even to the present day. Because those wee women were brought to the kingdom just for such a time as they were in. And so are you, and so am I. Mordecai and Esther didn't just complain about the situation. They trusted God. They prayed. And they stood up for the truth. They let their light shine. And God uses those three things to turn situations around. Let me close with this. D.L. Moody was once preaching. And he told a story. I remember Norman Fox telling it many years ago. But I looked it up myself and I've read about it. And he says, at Cleveland Harbour in America, there's a lighthouse. We sang the hymn just at the beginning. There's a lighthouse. And the lighthouse is shining. There's a ship coming in at night. At night, the lighthouse is shining. But you can't get into the harbour because there's rocks around it. It's a narrow, like, entrance into the harbour. And that's why in on the harbour, there were what they called the lower lights. Lights on the ground. And they have to be lit. And the only way into the harbour during the darkness was when you lined up the lower lights with the lighthouse and you got them in line, then you knew you were in the right place to go in between the rocks into the harbour. And Dale Moody says, he told, it's a true story, that one night the ship captain was coming in and he could see the lighthouse, but the lower lights had gone out. And there was nothing to line up with. And the storm was beating down. And he eventually decided we have to go in anyway, without the lower lights. But they didn't make it. They hit the rocks and the ship was destroyed. And lots of the sailors were lost because the lower lights weren't working. And Sankey heard this and he wrote the words, "Brightly beams our Father's mercy from his lighthouse evermore. But to us he gives the keeping of the lights along the shore. Let the lower lights be burning. Send the gleam across the way of some poor fainting seaman. You may rescue, may save. But the other bit, trim your feeble lamp, my brother. Some poor seaman, tempest-tossed, trying now to reach the harbour in the darkness, may be lost. Let the lower lights be burning. It's so true. The great light, brightly beams our Father's mercy from his lighthouse. What is God's mercy? Who is God's mercy? Who is the gospel? Jesus Christ. Where is he now? In heaven, ready to come back for his people. The gospel's beaming out, but who has to guide people to Christ? Who are the lower lights that line up with and to guide people to the gospel and to Christ? Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel. Make disciples of all nations. Be witnesses unto me both in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and unto the uttermost part of the earth. God's people are the lower lights. And they need to shine brightly to guide people to Christ. And we shine best when we're not looking back and thinking, oh, these days are terrible, Mordecai, these days are terrible, we're going to be persecuted. No. Praying, fasting, trusting, and making a stand. And the light so shines before men that they will see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Be encouraged. Continue on. Pray. Soldier on. Fight the fight. Trust in the Lord, and he can turn any situation around. Thank you for listening tonight, and the Lord bless you.